right, folks, we are back on the FlagStick.com T-Talk podcast. Stefan Tedor here with my co-host, as per usual, the pro, Scott Cloud. How are you?
Hey, good, man. How are you?
I'm okay. Not as good as DJ with his $15 million in the bank. But I'm okay. Played a lot of golf this weekend. Had a couple psycho scorecards. I had a front nine this week that included two birdies, an eagle, a triple, a double, and two bogeys. So,
what's wrong with that?
Figure that out. That's where my life is at. But hey, golf's fun. It's fun. I'm having fun. This is fun. Yeah,
that totally counts. I mean, I was out on the weekend as well. Got some games in, a couple of nine holers, a couple of 18s, and you know what? It's just nice to get out. And the fact that we're this far along in the year and we have gotten this much golf in, I think we all have to be thankful.
That's one way to put it. Where do you want to start this week? Do you want to get it the Tour Championship out of the way just to say we did it?
Yeah, might as well. I mean, I don't have a lot to say about it. You know, you and I have talked about it a fair bit. We've talked about it on this podcast, what it means or doesn't mean. But yeah, let's give DJ his due and we'll carry on. How's that?
Yeah, so Dustin Johnson wins. I'm going to put that into quotation marks. Xander Schauffele actually won it. But Dustin Johnson wins the Tour Championship, wins his 15 mil. Just another notch in this guy's belt where the stretch here of T2-1-2-1 is the DJ we all kind of expect, and that could come at any point ever. And then you just don't know what you're going to get every single week. I just, like we said it many times, I don't know how you could ever describe this guy's career to somebody in 20 years that will never see him play.
100% right. And we wonder how long this is going to carry on. Like, I mean, we're heading in now into the, you know, the new season starts immediately. We've got two majors still left to play this fall, but you know, is he just going to fall off form or is he going to stay on this form? Do people want him to stay on this form? I mean, as exciting as it can be in some aspects of it, other people are going, eh, we've had enough of DJ, but you know, you've got to respect the fact that he's got 23 wins already.
Yeah. And I haven't had enough of DJ. I love watching DJ. I think his game is great. I think he's underrated in so many facets. Everyone mm-hmm. understands the long drives and the ball striking. This guy chips and putts with anybody out there. He's always leaves me wanting more. I don't know why. The guy's won $67 million plus another 15 that he just won this week. But this is, like, just sidebar, this guy runs the Brinks truck. Brooks Koepka drives it. This guy owns it. This guy, he just won half of Brooks' career winnings this week. So Brooks can stuff his DJ, only has one major up his you-know-what, because he's clearly the better player, more consistently, and just overall, like, you're going to trade D. I guess, you know what? Let's go down this road real quick.
Yes.
You got Brooks's career. If they both ended today, Brooks's career or DJ's career, which one are you taking?
I'm taking DJ. You know what? He hasn't won as many majors, but I would say from a fulfilling your potential, the fact that you can come out and win four majors is fantastic for Brooks. But, you know, you underperform as far as the other events are concerned. You may play well. You may make enough money to drive the Brinks truck, but DJ gets it done. He's got the trophies, whether it's WGCs, obviously one major, potential for still tons more, but you know, he's already moved into 27th place all time, which sounds, you know, bad when you say it as far as all time wins, but you know, 23 wins is huge as far as a career is concerned. And I mean, you can't, here's the thing. You can't sit there and go, oh, Brooks has the potential to win 23. You have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's 100%. Really what it comes down. And DJ's done it.
And here's the craziest thing. DJ's worst year on tour, he had a win. His worst year money-wise was $1.8 million. This year, he's taken home $20 million. Now, it won't show up on the official money that way. It's going to show as like $5 million within a year where he obviously missed, you know, probably, if we look at the rest of his career, he's played around 20 events, you know, or more earlier in his career, as that's normal for guys, but around 20 events. So he's missed like six events this year. He's going to take home $6 million without that $15 million. So we're talking again, over $20 million this year. Still can't figure that out. He's made in one season, he made $9 million in one season. Like, this guy is just a machine from start to finish. What I loved about the weekend, and we're going to get into whether it was entertaining or not. My favorite part of the weekend was this new PR stunt that the PGA Tour 100% was putting in on DJ. And I don't know if you picked up on it but it was on the TV, but it was literally like, they're trying to make him seem like he's smart and he's like really dialed into, he's a big thinker and he just doesn't show it. And it's like this, you know, people are behind the scenes. Like, if he's going to keep doing this, we got to get something more out of him, because he can't just be the, for lack of better terms, the dumb guy.
Yeah. And 100% with that. I mean, Dan Hicks did it in his broadcast. You know, he made it sound out like, you know, DJ has overcome everything in the world. He's sitting there in the booth with Paul Azinger, you know, who came back from having cancer. And Dan Hicks is talking about all the things that DJ has had to deal with and to come back and overcome. Yeah, that's kind of overselling it a little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to, and I'm not saying, I'll be on the record before I get to this, I'm not saying there was any addictive issues for DJ before I say anything from here. But, and I'm not going to undersell addictions, because they are very much a real issue. But the issues that DJ has gone through outside of the injuries, yes, he's had some knee surgeries or whatever.
Sure.
They're self-inflicted.
Yeah. I mean, his legal issues, things that he had happening when he was in college, things like that. You're right. They are self-inflicted in a lot of those cases. So you're right. It's not the same situation as a, you know, major health issue. A major health issue is not falling down a set of stairs.
No.
Sorry. And that's not the case.
The stairs don't exist. And I will go on the record with that. They never did. They never will. It's a joke amongst the PGA Tour. Like, the guys out there joke about it, because everybody, it's like the worst kept secret. The stairs never existed. Neither did the Sea-Doo. Neither of them existed. These are self-inflicted wounds that DJ has brought upon himself. Again, he was young with a lot of money, and here we are. He's not young anymore, and it seems like he's settled down and he's got his life together. And I think Wayne Gretzky played a huge part on that. But I just thought it was funny that all these stories are coming out now about DJ. And I think it's literally that. They're like, holy, the guy's back. You know, he's back, another 3-win year after a down year of one. We got to start marketing this guy a little bit better than just having him stare at cameras in those weird RBC commercials that are on every other minute on Golf Channel.
Yeah, I mean, the PGA Tour is obviously going to protect their brand, and they'll do that with any athlete unless it's something that's, you know, so, you know, criminal that they can't do it. But, you know, whether it's Tiger Woods or Patrick Reed or whatever,
Tommy Two Gloves. Oh, sorry.
Exactly. They're going to gloss over or not talk about it. I mean, that's the regular spin you would expect from any organization. And especially this one, which is owned by the player. So, but trying to sell it, you know, the fans that are diehard fans are not believing it anyway. So I don't know why you would bother, but whatever the case, I mean, you know what, he got the win. Number 23, he's doing a lot of great things. Let's just see if he can do something at Wingfoot here, you know, next week, and, you know, coming up in November at the Masters.
Yeah, I'm excited for those two. You know, DJ's got to be the favorite. You're going to get awful odds on him right now just because of how hot he is. So watch out. I just want to go over this real quick, because you talked about protecting their brand. Now, the PGA Tour is built on one thing and one thing only, entertainment, because without entertainment, you don't make money. Without money, you don't have these players and these purses, yada, 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 right? Is the Tour Championship entertaining in its current format?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, obviously, he starts, you know, we talked about it. He started with a 2-stroke lead. I think, and as everybody else has said, there's got to be alternatives. You know, there are alternatives. I would rather see match play in here. I'd rather see some other format. I mean, again, some of the other stuff was probably worse before. I mean, at least this rewards, I guess, the FedEx.
At least we're
leader.
Not calculating something on every shot.
Right, exactly. So we'll give them that. They set it up so at least, you know, you can watch on Monday, the final round. It's easy to tell who's going to win the Tour Championship, who's going to win the FedEx Cup. But is it entertaining? It's probably anticlimactic more than anything. I think the golf course itself didn't really bring much to it. I would argue the week before the golf course at Olympia Fields brought more to it as far as excitement.
That would have been way flip those, and it's way it's way more entertaining. I agree 100%.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's a choice of, you know, obviously there's some sponsorship issues that's involved. Maybe it's preparation as far as the golf course is concerned. Maybe it doesn't have to be the format, but I can tell you when it came to the final round, I was playing golf for most of it, caught the highlights, caught the end. That was all I needed at that point. Once I knew DJ was ahead by that much heading into that final round.
Yeah. And it wasn't like they tried to sell it on TV to, you know, make it seem like at the end, you know, if something he does this, something's going to happen. It was locked. The guy can hit every fairway if he tries. Like, he can bunt it out there, three bills. He's fine. So it wasn't that. I agree with you. I think if I were the PGA Tour, people complain. The players complain. You know, the fans complain. At this point, get, you know, remember those silly Ryder Cup teams? The U.S. team, what was it called? The group they got together to...
Their dream team?
No, the group they got together to, like, fix their... I forget what they were called. Their focus group or whatever it was. Something silly.
Task force.
Their task force. That's what they need. They need the task force of the top PGA players. What would you do? Bring all the one... Bring the top 30 from last year. Bring them all in one room and let them design what they think what it should look like. The problem is, I don't doubt you're going to get anything crazy, but if you could, that's where you're actually going to get the best idea, because that way the players are going to be, they're going to put something on the line. Maybe they'll think about entertainment. Maybe they'll think about the tournament. Or maybe if you're DJ, be like, hey man, I won two of the playoff events. I should have a two-stroke lead going into that final event.
Yeah, I think what happens a lot of the cases, the Player Advisory Council does exist, but, you know, I've talked to other players before that have been involved with that. The process is sort of convoluted, and, you know, sometimes guys will bring together ideas that may sound like a great thing, but in the end, you know, there's a lot of protection for kind of what is, rather than bringing new ideas and things in there, and it takes a lot of effort to make that change. And really sometimes just guys go, forget it, you know, we're all making good money, then, you know, don't worry about it too much, don't rock the boat.
Yeah, maybe we're just trying to make something like they have been for years with the FedEx Cup, make something happen that just really doesn't bring a lot of interest overall. It's just another golf tournament on a Monday this time. Well, this week, I'm telling you, my interest lies not in the Safeway Open. We will get to the Safeway Open, you know, 2 days off from the PGA Tour. Let's give it at least 2 minutes where we talk about something else.
Sure.
The A&A Inspiration, you know, another major for the LPGA Tour. You know, I'm excited for it. I love majors regardless of which tour it's on. The real reason I'm excited for it is... it is so hot there that they have let the caddies take carts.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that for a moment, because I got some I got some information from caddies out there, players out there. But, you know, what else are you hearing about this event? Like 102 Fahrenheit out there?
Keep going. 120. Oh, it's getting up to it. Yeah. So what's happened for a lot of the players is that, for the caddies, for an example, no jumpsuits this week, which is their tradition there. They're going just to allow them just to have bibs. Like you said, carts are going to be allowed for the caddies. I mean, it has got to be close to dangerous for these players to be out there. I mean, if you've been out in that California desert, it is hot. And, you know, you can joke all you want about dry heat or whatever the case may be, but, you know, and you're not just out there for 5 hours. I mean, you have your warm-up time, you have all sorts of other things going on. I don't even know how a player is going to get enough water in them.
Yeah, and that's from a caddy perspective, and I'm just going to get to a couple caddies I chatted with. Both of them I chatted with, three of them I chatted with, all said that they actually plan on still walking and carrying the bag this week, just because of the, you know, you lose too much in that player caddy dynamic. I would see, you know, families or where you have like the boyfriend caddying, or, you know, somebody that's really not a caddy. They are a carrier.
Sure.
I'll put myself probably in that category, but, you know, out there that they, you know, the player caddy dynamic doesn't matter. Those people probably really aren't in contention anyway. Probably. I'm going to use probably very loosely, because you probably would have said that about the last major champion prior to them winning. but that's my understanding, is that the player caddy dynamic is too important, in the tournament to be taking a cart, because the players can't go on the cart. So is it really
much difference for the player to walk beside the caddy as they look like the biggest slob ever just sitting in the cart. But my only thought is the water, because my understanding is that most tours, at least at the start, weren't giving out water during the tour. So they must be doing it this week at the LPGA.
Yeah, I'm not sure, because I saw the Korn Ferry Tour qualifier yesterday, and they were not providing water at the golf course for the players. And in fact, that some of the players were carrying gallons of jugs of water out there and forcing their caddies to take it. So I don't know what the situation is for there. And I agree with you as far as the player is concerned, that, and the caddy, that relationship's so strong that, you know, you don't want to be just riding along in a cart beside them. You're not going to be involved with the decisions. You're not going to be involved with, you know, kind of what you need to do. And yeah, it just seems, it seems like it's something they're doing for the public. They're kind of out front. I guess they're probably a situation where maybe there's a few caddies that, you know, might need it from a health reason. You never know. You're obviously not trying to, risk
some grinders out there on the LPGA tour.
Exactly. You guys have been out there quite some time.
Yeah. You they're almost eating themselves out of caddy.
Yeah. You don't want to risk their health for sure, but it almost seems a little bit more PR-like just to make it look good a little bit. Cause otherwise, I mean, I know it's integral to the game. You want them to walk, but you know, getting to those temperatures, they are pretty extreme. That's going to be a very difficult situation for any of the players. And hopefully, you know what, they all get through there without any medical issues.
Would it have been a big deal just let the players cart too? Like, I don't think that's a huge problem. What's the difference of the caddy carting? Like, let the players, would it have changed anything for you watching the tournament? Like, do you really watch it to watch them walking between shots? I don't even want to watch them walking at all. Show me another shot.
Yeah, and I know what you're saying. And I mean, they do say, you know, it's integral to the game.
No, as far as
walking, their physical fitness. This is their argument. This is what they're trying to say. But you know what? I don't know if there's an unfair advantage for one player over another. In this situation, you know, if you're going to go and make some sort of, different accommodations for a player's health, you might as well just go all the way.
Oh, I agree 100%. Just do it. Make it happen. Everyone on the same playing field. Make it mandatory. Be like, you have to take a cart. Like, I don't, you know what I mean? Like, let's just make it.
It's an exceptional week.
Yeah, it's not the norm. You know, we're not doing it every week. I get it, it's a major, whatever. But you're already going away from all your other traditions. You said the jumpsuits, caddies taking a cart. You know, let's just get it done. Let's keep everyone safe. And who knows? It is, you know, as we record, it's only Tuesday. This could change by Thursday. Who knows? Maybe carts come into play by the time this podcast comes out. And then the whole time you guys are just fast forwarding through this, hitting that 30-second mark till we're done talking about this silly tournament. But I'm excited for it. And, you know, who are you looking at from a standpoint for this major? Anyone pop out to you that, you know, this is a place that you think their game should transition over?
Ooh, I mean, I think we talked about it a little bit, last week. Daniel Kang obviously playing very, very well. Se-young Kim, defending champion here. The two Canadians tied for 17th last year, Elena Sharp and Brooke Henderson. Brooke has not looked sharp early on, which is kind of funny when you say Elena Sharp and then Brooke's not looking sharp. But they did tie for 17th. They were part of that tie last year here. There's potential for that. It all depends on the weather. I mean, it's hot, but it can also be windy there as well. And you get a lot of winds come up and, you know, it can start to benefit some of the longer hitters. But generally, it's like playing in a bubble. So really hard to pick. Really hard to pick.
That's fair. Looking forward to that. That starts Thursday. The ANA Inspiration, you know, that next major for the LPGA this year. As we did touch on, though, the Safeway Open, the start of the 2020-2021 season. It's here. We're back. Unfortunately, it's not starting with the Greenbrier this year. RIP to the Greenbrier. We're at the Safeway Open already. And I think the only story I want to touch on with the Safeway Open is this Graeme Dillette is back in the field. I know he was looking forward to getting back out there. What are you hearing? What's Graeme been talking about this week? Has he mentioned anything about his back at all?
No, I haven't seen much from him so far. I haven't seen really any interviews, and I really haven't followed much as far as social is concerned. But, you know, he seemed very confident in the last few weeks on social, talking about it, the fact that he was going to be back for this. So, you know, hopefully, it won't be like the Sony when he came back in January where things didn't quite go so well. Maybe he'll be a little bit more ready this time. And, hopefully, you know, he's in Northern California, got some decent weather. He's had some decent finishes before at that event. So hopefully it's familiar ground for him, and he's feeling okay. Because, you know, as we know, he's a much beloved player in Canada. He's played well in the past, obviously made a President's Cup team, great ball striker. Everybody wants to see this guy do well, and they want him to return to the game successfully.
Yeah, the last I heard from him, it's still that every morning's a new day. Like, he doesn't know. Yeah. And that's, in a golf world, that's tough, right? Yeah. You know, say you play really well on the first day, and now the next day you come out, you don't even know if you're back. Like, your back turns up. It's like, can I get through this? You know, we've seen success stories. You know, Kevin Chappell came back and obviously shot 59 at the Greenbrier and then kind of never really saw him again all year. Even that tournament, I don't think he broke 70 outside of that round. It's these back injuries that you know, Tiger, I think we got to stop thinking even Tiger's body isn't like everybody else's body.
No.
Right? Just because this guy came back from an insane back injury doesn't mean other people will. We obviously are big fans of Graham. We hope he gets out there, and we're hoping for a good week. We'd love to see him at least make the cut this week, and I know that's probably his only goal this week.
Yeah, he's had some surgeries, and I just look back, you know, 3 years prior to this, back at that PGA when I was down at Quail Hollow, and, you know, he was struggling. He was playing well, and then all of a sudden, you know, he's got the electronics therapy on going. He's got everything going that week. They're trying to do anything to get his back ready, and, you know, this might be the case right now. We don't know. He hasn't really kind of revealed that, but hopefully that's the case. He can kind of get through four rounds successfully and play well.
I love it. Well, I think we should talk some more Canadian golf, and the best way to talk Canadian golf is to actually talk with a fellow Canadian that is golfing on the Canada Life Series currently. Who do we have this week, Scotty, for our feature interview?
Yeah, we've got Caleb Gorbon joining us. Caleb's from Smithers, BC. He's not a player a lot of people might be familiar with, but he just won the Vancouver Open. He's had a couple of wins on the Outlaw Tour as well. Definitely an up-and-coming Canadian, and I think people will enjoy hearing his story. All right, we want to welcome to the podcast Caleb Gorbon, not Bon. Caleb Gorbon.
There we go.
Smithers, BC. We promised not to butcher that, so we got the proper pronunciation, but an emerging young Canadian talent, and certainly we want to hear from him, and we want to introduce him to a lot of listeners as well. Like I said, an emerging Canadian talent, so welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I just want to start off a little bit. Like I said, I'll call you an emerging talent, but you've had some success so far. But why don't you give us a little bit of your backstory?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm from a small town up in northern BC, Smithers. It's a town of 5,000 people. I was introduced to the game, like, right away. I don't remember a time that I didn't have the clubs in my hand. It was something that I was really passionate about. I played a bunch of other sports growing up. I tried to stay active because we only got, you know, the 4 good months of golf. So that was obviously, that was a big part of my life, is all different sorts of sports. I did, you know, acting in high school, theater in high school and choir, all that. When if our school offered something, that's what I was doing. I was trying to stay busy as much as I could. And then, you know, I had an okay junior career. I wouldn't say anything special. Got an opportunity to play golf in South Bend, Indiana for TJ Mannon at Holy Cross, and which was NAIA. I spent the first 2 years there before transferring to Nevada for Jacob Wilner. Finished up my 2 years there, and then turned pro fall of 2018, and loving everything about it for sure.
All right, so let's turn back that clock a little bit. You skipped quickly through growing up in the Bulkley Valley. That is an area I'm somewhat familiar with. We've had some conversations about that online, but why don't you tell people a little bit about, you know, being in a small town and growing up as a golfer and thinking about golf as maybe a profession and, you know, maybe the limits that you maybe thought you had on you.
Yeah. I mean, growing up in the North was, at the time, I didn't like it because I thought that it was very hard to get recognized being there. And I think even to this day, I may not get the kind of attention that some of these other kids may have gotten growing up that were in the Vancouver area or the Greater Toronto area, or so be it. But looking back, it was a great place to grow up. But, you know, growing up, if you didn't play hockey, no one cared, right? When I got my scholarship to play golf in the U.S., you know, I remember, you know, telling athletic director of our high school that I just got a scholarship to go play golf in the U.S. And they said, oh, cool. They didn't do anything about it, none of that, because if you didn't play hockey, it didn't matter. So there was a little bit of a chip under my shoulder because of that stuff that I had grown up, you know, where I didn't get that kind of attention. It's been kind of a bit of a learning experience when things come in, when you get those messages or people writing about you or whatever it is, to kind of take it in stride, because it was something that I was not used to. Or, you know, I'd be playing well in an event, and I'll see, you know, Twitter going crazy about me, and I'm like, that's new to me. It wasn't something that I was used to. So that's kind of been a learning process for me, to kind of block a lot of the stuff out as much as I could. But, you know, at the same time, what was great about living in the Bulkley Valley was, yes, we only had one golf course, but, and it was a pretty great golf course for where we were. And I had the opportunity to play 54 holes, sometimes more if I wanted to. And I had no problem getting out. And I think, you know, if I were to go somewhere else, where the membership's a lot higher, there's not really that free for all. I mean, the golf course is 5 minutes from the middle of town. I mean, it doesn't take long to get around Smithers. So I could just jump on my bike and go to the golf course, and I'd be there from sun up to sundown, and, you know, I enjoyed it. There were some times that we would play, you know, there was one day that us juniors, we played 100 holes in one day. We just tried to see how many holes we could get in. I think it was like 104 holes before we had to call it quits. So that was another thing that was really nice about growing up in the North, was we had the long days, so I could make up for the lost time of the winter, because I had all day to work on my game during the summer.
Yeah, that's it's always fun to hear about these quirky small town golf courses that, you know, kids grew up on. Let's just talk about that golf course. Said it was great for the area. You've obviously played some great courses, and we're going to get to where you're playing right now, but just give us a quick description, like give us a mental image of this golf course you grew up on.
You know, what was great about it is there's a couple holes out there that are really quality holes. Our second hole, it's this par five. It's probably one of the best par fives I've ever played. And if I'm just looking back at it, like if I were to redesign holes on the golf course, I would not even touch the second hole. It is spectacular. It's tight. But the thing that out there, and why I think I got really good at, hitting drivers or even my iron play, was because I had to do a lot of it. When I hit driver, I had to hit a good drive. And then the holes that you couldn't hit driver, you have to, you know, really work the ball a little bit or get a lot more practice of hitting and positioning yourself with a six or five iron, like we have to do out there. So I think there's a lot of those things that my ball striking absolutely came from where I grew up. As far as the short game aspect of it, you know, we didn't have, you know, the condition wasn't always nice. It was all dependent on what our winter was like. The greens were usually slow. So when I have to go to other tournaments, especially growing up, and I'd start jumping on faster greens, it was quite the transition for me, or there was something difficult about, you know, all of a sudden I went from swinging a putter as hard as I could to just breathing on it. So that's one thing that, you know, I wish that the greens were faster, but again, from where we were at and how far north we were and the limited funds that our maintenance crew had, they did a great job, as well as they could have done, for sure. And the views are pretty good.
Yeah, they are pretty good up there. For you then, as you worked your way through your collegiate career, as you said, started out at Holy Cross, obviously then went to Nevada after that. How did your game progress for those, that process of the, over those years? And when did you possibly start to think about playing professionally?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like many people who want to play professional golf, they dream of it as soon as they, you know, start playing competitive golf. They dream of playing it for a living. But what, you know, something that my dad had really stressed on with me was that as long as you're getting better each and every year, right? Like, you don't have to be this superstar right off the bat. You're not expected to be. But we could only travel to 3-4 tournaments a year where some people weren't. So when I got over to the US and got to play a lot more events and playing, you know, higher levels of competition, you start to learn a little bit more about your game, what you're good at, what you're bad at. And so, you know, I always felt that I was a really good ball striker, and even in junior years to now, I think I'm a really good ball striker. What's lacking is the short game, like I alluded to earlier. But watching other people, and there was a guy on our team, Grant Booth, when I got to Nevada, who was a spectacular chipper and pitcher of the ball. So having now resources and people to talk to and pick their brain has been very beneficial for me, especially being that since I struggled with it, coming from a place where you didn't have that kind of information and then going somewhere where that information was available to you, the progression of my game, like I said, has gotten better and better each and every year. And each and every year, I feel more and more comfortable that I am in the right field right now, that I am, you know, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And hopefully I continue that trend of getting better and better each year.
Well, I think it's fair to say, you know, you could call yourself a late bloomer maybe, or the fact that, hey, I just didn't have the resources available to me. I got them late. Doesn't mean I'm late. I just got the resources everyone else got early, later. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's, you know, looking over your final year at Nevada, there's nothing in there that would pop out being like, watch out for this guy to be a upcoming tour pro by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, that's 2 years ago, or it might be almost 3 years ago now. Throw that out the window. Because, you know, we're 3-for-3 through the season on made cuts on the McKenzie Tour and the Canada Life Series right now. If you told, you know, 3 years ago, Caleb, that this is where you'd be right now, you know, 3-for-3 on the McKenzie Tour, which is a pretty big tour. I understand it's not the elite talent it usually is from year in, year out. But still, it's something to write home about. You know, what would Caleb 3 years ago be thinking?
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you say that, and just because it's exactly that, you know, that if you were to look at my career, you would say, what the heck is this guy doing turning professional? You know, he's got no track record of showing that he's got what it takes to.
Don't worry, neither did Scott, so he tried to.
Yeah, that's why he's interviewing us here. So, but I always felt like, you know, when I compare myself to other guys in Division I golf, you know, I left the golf course demoralized that I just lost to these people by 3, 4, 5 shots or whatever that day, because I knew that I had certain aspects of my game that would absolutely qualify for someone who could play this game for a living. And, you know, I knew that just through maturity and getting the proper resources that I would be able to get there, and I'm not quite there yet. I'm working really hard, as hard as I can. But if you were to tell me, you know, 3 years ago that you made 3 cuts on the McKenzie Tour in a row, I'd be like, cool, for sure, right? Like, that's, I don't want to sound arrogant, but that's what I expect of myself. And I would also say that these last 3 events, I didn't play very well, but to be able to cash a check in the last, I think it's like 9 in a row now that I've cashed a check, that's good progress for me.
And you've had some other highlights in there as well. I mean, we're talking about made cuts, but you've had some wins too, including the most recent Vancouver Open win, which again is certainly significant. As we know, there's a depth of talent in British Columbia, a lot of great players playing on that tour. You've also had success on the Outlaw Tour. So what did those victories mean to you?
Yeah, obviously they're huge. Just to get the feeling of winning golf tournaments. It was the fourth time that after that Vancouver Open, it was the fourth time that I cashed a first place check in 8.5 months or something like that. So obviously the feeling of winning and being in contention, money aside of cashing the check is big building blocks for me because, like you may have said, Stephen, that I was kind of a bit of a late bloomer by some people's standards. I didn't win as a junior. I won very few events. I won my first college event that I played in, and I didn't win anything from then on. I came second a couple times here and there. But to get the feeling of winning and coming down the stretch and hitting shots that matter, that's huge in itself. So obviously what they're doing in the VGT, Fraser does a tremendous job and is in complete support of the players. He really does look after the players and wants to see them succeed. And I think that's a big reason why we have a lot of good players coming out of BC that not only myself, but a lot of other guys that could be defined as up and coming Canadian professionals for sure.
Yeah. You know, it's not like you were fighting off nobody's out there to win. You did win by two. A little 65 in the final round of the Vancouver Open to pick up, just five-figure check. You can look it up if you're worried about how much those five figures are, but a nice five-figure check for a tour pro in a weird year too, right? Like, I'm sure this is probably when you opened up the calendar year this year, this was the year where you're like, okay, I got to build up where I'm going. Am I going to Arizona? Am I going to Florida? Where am I going to try to make some money? And then boom, here comes COVID. Well, that's going to throw some things in, a wrench at me. So how am I going to dodge that and keep going? What were your thoughts when that all first came down, and how much did that change your plan for the year?
Yeah. Like you said, this year was going to be a big year for me. And I was really looking forward to it. I was starting to play really well on the Outlaw Tour before all COVID happened. And when it first hit and it was looking like we weren't going to have a Mackenzie Tour season, Q schools were going to get canceled, all of this stuff, there was, it hit deep, and you're obviously really disappointed. And it was really tough to motivate yourself to get out and practice. There were many times where I'd be out there, I'd just be going through the motions because what am I working towards? So when I got back to Canada, the Canada Life Series wasn't happening. The VGT was throwing maybe just a couple events. You didn't know what events were going to come or what your schedule was going to look like. So I was kind of preparing myself of, I guess you could say a little vacation from golf when I got home, that I would just be doing a bunch of fishing and stuff like that.
But like, how did that, like, I'm sure the vacation idea was great, but at the same time, you're like, I'm sure it took a toll on you in the sense of like, damn, is this going to work? Because, how many years can I really do this? And then you're probably getting in your own head about, what am I doing right now? Cause I don't know about you. I'm not a great fisher. I don't think you can make money catching sunfish off the dock. but maybe you could, but you got to make ends meet somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously I was gutted, because you don't know how long you're going to have the funds to be able to do that kind of stuff. I hadn't had much success in Q school. I've come close many times. And I was really looking forward to Q school for the Mackenzie Tour this year because I was starting to play really well and before it got canceled. But a lot of the other professional golfers, they kind of rolled over and just, complained or, got down on themselves and this kind of stuff. But we're all in the same boat, and I tried really hard, and it wasn't easy, but you had to just kind of be like, it is what it is. what can I gain out of it? Obviously it was great. The Canada Life came out with this stuff and I was able to actually have, you know, I was traveling, playing events. I'm on my 10th week of living out of my suitcase. That wasn't expected at the start of the summer. And so when it, you know, it's really great that this all had happened, but I was prepared of just making the most out of it. You know, when I say vacation, just fishing, you know, I was definitely going to have to work a little bit because I need to make ends meet, and I wasn't going to be able to make it on the golf course. So that's not what I was expecting to. But, you know, it's all about the attitude that you have to have because, again, we're all in the same boat. It sets us back a whole year, especially on developing pros. But if you just sit down and just be like really down on yourself, you're not going to make it. You got to have a better attitude than that if you want any chance of getting through. Obviously, it's hard times, but, you know, if you can't handle that, then you have no business. Keep trying, to be honest.
So it sounds like you've learned a lot in these last couple of years. Obviously, as a pro, you know, there is a certain path that you're taking where you're, you know, all of a sudden different hazards come up, different obstacles. But what have you learned about yourself even in just the last 2 years that maybe you didn't think you would know about yourself 2 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a process, right? I'm learning from each round that I play. I'm learning about how to interact with other people, how to run my pro career as if it's a business, right? Making harder decisions, having tough conversations with people you love and that kind of stuff. Things that I was kind of fearful of doing or kind of learning some more independence for myself. And I think that's really important. You know, as far as learning on the golf course, it's still a work in progress. Like, I don't think it will ever stop, but the maturity level is most certainly there. In college, I got really down on myself. I was very negative and, you know, it cost me a lot. And even last week, you know, I was three back of the league going in halfway through the tournament. And, you know, I hit a couple bad shots and I got really down on myself. I got frustrated. The group dynamic wasn't very good. And it cost me, you know. Fortunately, I was able to make the cut, but then I go in the next day and I just wasn't mentally prepared to grind out another day in the wind. And it cost me. I shoot a terrible round the last day. So these are things that I'm continuing to learn and process and sit back and talk about with my coaches or family on how I can deal with things better. So, but I definitely do feel the level of maturity is the biggest thing. I'm not totally matured, but it's come a long way in the last 2 years because I've been put in situations where you have to become mature.
Yeah. I think golf, professional golf does that to you. You know, I think back to where I was at 22 and, you know, I don't have the mindset of that, of one bad shot. Yeah, it's who, you know, let's fight through it. So I think it's clear that, you know, making sure that you're mentally in the right place is important to you. What do you work on outside of the golf course to ensure, you know, your health from head to toe is important?
Yeah, so these are steps that I've only recently started to take. I haven't truly taken them yet. These are all works in progress, but I'm going to be starting in October 1st, working with a physical trainer. October, I think 15th, I got a meeting with a sports psychologist and that kind of stuff. There's kind of a bit of a stigma on sports psychologists that it's like a last resort of giving up. Right. You're so crazy in your head that it's time for you to get a sports psychologist. Right. You don't have it naturally. But for me, I finally realized that, you know, if you want to be at the best level, even if you don't feel like you may need it, you do. Working on these subtle keys to, you know, be sharper on a golf course is really important. Sometimes they don't happen naturally and you have to have somebody who might be able to walk you through those kinds of steps.
Yeah, I think there's still stigmas about just general therapy in general, right? I don't think, you know, what you're talking about with sports psychology is to get you through, you know, the mental hurdles and the sport you're dealing with. And there's no difference in regular therapy as well, just with everyday life. And there should be no stigma around either of them. One's a business and one's, you know, your overall life in general.
Yeah. And I mean, for me, growing up, I suffered from depression. And, you know, it's something that has affected not only myself, but my family. My brothers and sisters, they all have it. And anxiety, it was a tough time for me growing up, which also gave me thicker skin. But it's a tough and difficult path when you have those kind of issues. And I was very, you know, reserved. I wasn't sharing those things with like my family and that kind of stuff. I kept to myself. I kept busy as much as I could. Like I said, I did, you know, everything that I could to keep my mind off of it. Where other people, they don't do that. They don't have a healthy way of coping with their depression or their anxiety. And I think that over the, you know, last 4 to 6 years, as I've progressed in getting better. I mean, I went to a, when I was in college, I went to a, a counselor and talked to them about those kinds of things, which helped me a lot. And I encouraged, you know, my family to do those kinds of things. And, it's all become better in that sense.
And I think that goes back to this whole idea that, you know, you're a late bloomer. And I don't think that is the case. I think, you know, we put expectations on kids younger and younger to be in a certain place. And it sounds like you are exactly where you're supposed to be at the right time. You had to do growing outside of a silly game where you're just hitting a white ball somewhere. I'd rather have done what you're doing at the age you're doing now and then get golf later in life when you're more ready for it than, you know, be really good at golf and just a horrible person outside of that side of things. So I think you took your path, and that's the important thing to recognize. So let's talk about that path. Where does it go from here? The Mackenzie Tour Canada Life Series wraps up this week with its final event at TPC Osprey Valley. Obviously, COVID's still out there, so it's a little hard to make too much of a schedule. But what's the plans from here going into the next year?
Yeah, so obviously finish up this week, like you said. I'll play a couple more just one-day events on the VGT before I kind of pack it up a little bit. You know, I've been so go, go, go with golf. I haven't really taken a full break from golf since basically high school because the snow would stop me from doing it. So it's going to be nice after this month that I'll be able to put the clubs a bit in the closet, spend some time with my family, not be out of a suitcase. That's going to be really nice. I don't know exactly when I'm going to get down to Phoenix. I'm planning on it. I just don't know exactly the date. It kind of all depends with all this COVID stuff when I'll be able to do that. And then I'll just be gearing up for Mackenzie Tour again, because of what has happened with the COVID-19, there won't be many options for Q schools all over the world. You know, I went to South Africa last year. They're going to have to redo their Q school. I went to Latin America. They're going to have to redo their Q. They're not going to be able to do their Q school. So Mackenzie Tour is kind of the only one that will be on the calendar for a lot of people. So I'll go down there to Phoenix, you know, hopefully by the new year, and work on my game, play some of those outlaw events, and just get the game back and sharp, and work with my coach, Aaron Olson and Brian Pate. And, you know, hopefully next year we can find some normalcy and, you know, that I can continue to play good golf and continue to win golf tournaments.
All right. Well, that's great. We really appreciate you coming on. Certainly, not only to talk about golf, but also to talk about other issues, other different things as well, which are very important. And you're right. You know, people have to recognize that mental health issues are just part of being alive. Really, they are. And there's no stigma that should be connected to them. So we wish you the best of luck. Congratulations on your success so far. Good luck this week at TPC Toronto Osprey Valley. And we'll be following you as you go forward in your career.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Caleb, for that interview. We look forward to watching you on the Canada Life series and, you know, the rest of your career. You know, I like the conversation we had about, you know, you don't need a path that everyone else took. You don't need to be somewhere at a certain time. Not everyone's Jordan Spieth and comes out of college after their second year and wins on the PGA Tour. It sounds like the guy's got the game, though, to get there. He's winning. If you're winning multiple times out on that Outlaw Tour, especially this year, and then, you know, the Vancouver Golf Tour, which, let's not forget, Nick Taylor played out there this year and didn't win. They're good players. So, you know, I think a lot of people brush over these interviews that we have, but one day you're going to look back and be like, hey, I remember that name, and it's going to be from this podcast.
Yeah, I think everybody paints people into a box of, you know, their path and how they have to go up. And, you know, Derek Inger and the Team Canada coach who we've had on this podcast before always says, you know, success is not linear. It's not a linear path. And it shouldn't, you know, look one way. And, you know, Caleb's obviously having success in his own way. Got a tremendous amount of talent. I expect a lot from him. And, you know, that's why we bring him on. That's why we bring some of these guys on, just to expose them to our audience and let people know about these up and coming players and how talented they really are.
You're absolutely right, Scotty. I think that's the key. You know, just because this guy wasn't on Team Canada doesn't mean, you know, guys like Derek Ingram don't know about him. He's been watching him. We all have been. So I'm looking forward to watching Caleb's career now that, you know, we got to know him a little bit, and just a great guy, got a good head on his shoulders, knows what's important in life, and taking care of himself on and off the golf course, which we like to see. Let's talk about some other things happening. The 2020 season obviously wrapped up. We talked about that off the top. We'll eventually get to our thoughts overall on the 2020 golf season this year. I think, you know, you had it as a topic, but I'm not ready to talk about it. It's September 2nd. I don't know what the day it is. We've been in COVID for 2 years. We'll talk about that in December, right? What I want to talk about, I want to go down the tour a little bit. I think we're going to get to an awards season here. You know, the player of the year topic, the rookie of the year topic. Let's just go over the player of the year topic just quickly. Who is it for you? Is it DJ? Is it Justin? Who are you feeling?
Two letters, DJ. It really has to be. I mean, it's just, you know, there's just too much there. I mean, JT obviously had a little bit of a case, maybe if he won the tour championship, but I think DJ's your guy. Just the consistency that's there. Obviously, like you said, you know, JT is in the mix, but I think DJ's your guy.
Now, what about Colin Morikawa? This guy won a major. He won another one. He didn't win so let's say that's two, right? He didn't win a third. He didn't. That was Xander Schauffele. I get those guys mixed up. You know, he didn't win a 30-man tournament. You know, is he not getting enough love for Player of the Year? Because for me, that's kind of where I'm leaning. I don't know why. That's kind of where I'm leaning right now.
I think he's a side vote, but I don't think he's in the main picture. I really don't think so. Obviously, the PGA made the big difference there. Certainly, he might get a few votes from some of the players, but it usually comes down to a two-man race. It's rarely, you know, three names in the picture there. And I think JT had made his case early. DJ made his case early. You know, Colin came late there, obviously winning that PGA. But I think just the dominance, even within the tour. Not just the tour championship, but within the FedEx Cup playoffs as well. DJ going 30 under in Boston, you know, winning the tour championship, despite the fact it is only 30 players. It's the top 30 players that made it into that. I won't say they're the top 30 players in the world. I heard references to that earlier today by somebody, but you know, he beat the top horses when he had to, and you got to give him credit for that, even if he had a two-stroke lead to spot the field.
Yeah, that's fair. So I'm just going to look at it quickly. Colin Morikawa made just over $5 million in 21 events. DJ did that in 14.
and Justin Thomas did $7 million and 18. Now, we're not obviously including the FedEx Cup. We get it. DJ won $20 million. He could retire now and have the best life ever. He already does. But, I think there's an argument still here for JT. He won three full field events. He was also on the President's Cup, but so was DJ. It doesn't really matter. I don't know. I'm conflicted. My heart wants to say Morikawa. I do think it's DJ, though. 14 events to do what everyone else did. If he played those other four events, I think DJ's getting a $7 million for sure. Yeah. There's no way he's not getting $2 million across, four events. Actually, that's no way, but you know what I mean. Like, he could have easily won those. Who knows?
Yeah, he could have at least, you're going to give him at least one event within that and possibly two, but at least one. So definitely when we break it down per event, he's definitely the leader in the clubhouse, I think.
How about, though, JT, only missing two cuts all year, one at the Sony and then the other one at the Genesis. Oh, three cuts and at the Travelers. Wow, sorry, never mind. This guy, no, not the player of the year. Give it to DJ. What about I think the more interesting debate, though, is the rookie of the year. And they were talking about Scottie Scheffler versus Victor Hovland. It's going to come down to one of these two guys. Let's say this. You're going to make the argument for Scottie Scheffler. I will make the argument for Victor Hovland. Why is Scottie Scheffler the rookie of the year for you?
For me, I know he didn't get a win, but, he just had a lot of consistencies, seven top tens. He was in the top 25, 13 times, in the mix of the PGA, as far as a major, probably surprised a few people, but six times he was in the top five. So he was in contention a fair bit, even though he didn't get a win. Hovland was a guy that we watched early on. We had big expectations from him, but I think Scheffler outshone him. And I think head-to-head as well, I think Scheffler has done a little bit better than Hovland. What are your thoughts? Why do you think Hovland is your guy?
Well, I mean, one word, win. You got to win. At the end of the day, if you don't win, why are you the rookie of the year? Now let's step back a year, because if that was the case, Martin Trainer would have been the rookie there last year.
Instead it's an opposite field event. It's a Puerto Rico Open.
Instead of Sungjae Im. Yeah. I get the argument. Scheffler, realistically, Scheffler made almost $1 million more. He did play three more events than Hovland. You kind of touched on a couple other stats there. So Scheffler, top fives. He had six top fives. That's crazy. Hovland had two. Top tens, it was 7-3 Scheffler. Top 25s, it was 13-9 Scheffler. But at the end of the day, nobody cares about that. Right? Like, you don't get into the Hall of Fame for
top five finishes.
Nobody's getting into the Hall of Fame. Like, that's great. You made more money than Victor Hovland, but at the end of the year, Victor Hovland won a tournament, which, just quickly, was he in the field? He was in the field out there. He didn't win it. Hovland won it. So for me, it's got to be Hovland.
But I would give it more merit if it wasn't the Puerto Rico Open, if it wasn't an opposite field event.
Whoa. Don't talk about the Puerto Rico Open like that.
I know it's a major in the Martin Trainer's household and for his caddy. But, I think really when we look at it, it's like a super Corn Ferry Tour event, really what it is. No disrespect. It is a PGA Tour event. I get it. But if you look at it head to head, it's best rookie. It's rookie of the year. It's not rookie who won a tournament and didn't do as well as the other guy.
That's fair. I can't get past it. I think here's another thing. Scheffler missed five cuts. Hovland missed three. Hovland also did this entire thing while being high out of his mind. Clearly, look at the guy. There's no way this guy's sober out there. So I don't know. For me, it's got to be Victor. Scheffler is 2 years older. He's also way bigger, 6'3". This guy's just a natural. Hovland, he's listed at 5'9". He's like 5'8".
Are you making it a height contest?
It's now a height contest. I'm going by this guy has less to work with. I saw him at the Greenbrier. He's not 5'10".
He's tiny.
No, he's a tiny dude. I go on with my guy. He's more entertaining. If, to be honest with you, here, let's step back. If we had the PGA Championship, if Scheffler wasn't in the mix on Sunday and he wasn't all over the TV, is your answer still the same? Do you even think about him?
No, because he's sort of that guy that sort of creeps in there and you look in the leaderboard and he's sort of hanging out there, but he's not Brendan Todd, you know, he's not winning all of a sudden the events, but he's in the mix, but he hasn't kind of broke through yet. So, you know, I think you can make an argument either way. I understand where you're going from with Hovland. Obviously he had a very consistent season as well, did get a win. So maybe a flip of the coin with a touch of the coin going a little bit more over to Scheffler for me. How's that?
All right. I'm going to frame this question one last way. Of these two players, one of them goes to the Hall of Fame. Who do you feel has a better chance of getting there?
In what country?
I'm talking about the World Golf Hall of Fame in Florida, next to the Bear, the Squire, the Slammer, the Squire, whatever that Gary Player commercial is. You got to pick one. Who's going there and why?
I think you're probably going to go Hovland, because I think Hovland is a little bit more dynamic. And I think, you know, he's a guy that will probably break out more and have more wins, where I think Scheffler will be a grinder, might get a couple of wins in his career, will have a lot of top tens. But you know what? Let him shine for 1 year and then Hovland can have the rest of it. How's that?
I'm actually going the other. I'm going Scotty. I think he's just got a bigger career of winning, right? Like, obviously this is his first full season out on the PGA Tour. He's playing a bunch of US Opens. You don't get up into major championships without the game, especially your first year out there. Obviously he's played in a bunch, but still, like, I think he's bigger. Where the game's going is, if they roll back the golf ball too, right? Like, he's going to be fine. He'll probably still hit it long. Yeah, I'm actually going the other way. I think Scotty's going to pick up a win here at some point in the next year.
Let's revisit this in 20 years and then we'll find out. How's that?
Yeah. I can't wait to meet at the retirement home and talk to you about Scotty Scheffler at the bookie in between bridge games. A couple other things came out this week. New gear. Titleist launching their new drivers. You know, obviously Ping in the previous week kind of leaked out a couple of theirs out in Japan, but Titleist has their new TSI series drivers. You've seen them. What do you know about them? What can you say about them?
Not much. Really have a lot of details. They're obviously seeding them this week at the Safeway Open and over at the European Tour as well. So, you know, the players are getting their first chances to get a chance to hit the final versions of them. I'm sure they've hit some prototypes in the last little while, but certainly we're going to see them in play here. Don't know too much about the technology that they've added to them. Certainly have seen some markings on the face that, you know, indicate that possibly they're using some of the titanium that they've made use of in their C16 product like 4 years ago, some of their prototype sort of experimental stuff that was used in the crowns of the C16 drivers. Just expecting a mild evolution here is what we usually see from Titleist, you know, building on what they did with the TS drivers, which are obviously very solid. They'll have some little bit of some tweaks in here. TSI 3, we're seeing a sliding weight on the back, which is something new that we have not seen from Titleist. So that's a jump up for them, considering, you know, they've been using some movable weight technology, but in a cartridge. This has got a track that's on it. So we'll see where they're going with that. But I'm not expecting huge things, just a mild, like I said, a mild evolution of what they've done very successfully with the TS2 and the TS3 previously.
Yeah, I've obviously heard the guys out on tour, they're hitting it a long way. Weird. Who would have thought that would come out this week when a new driver's out? Who would have thought? Speaking about him.
Well, what I did think was funny, and I'll, before we get to it, I saw postings of a one player showing some yardages and you know, they were using a GC quad as far as their launch monitor, which is a camera based device, which is just measuring impact. It's not tracking the ball for the long distance. And, you know, somebody was referring to and said, oh, they were probably in Utah or something to get those distances. Well, unless they actually set the temperature change, the barometer change, the elevation change, it wouldn't equate to those distances. It's really, you know, it's just measuring what's happening at impact. So the numbers that I saw didn't really make sense. So I'll reserve judgment until really we get a chance to test this out in a few weeks.
I will you won't say it, but I will. That was Jimmy Walker you're talking about with a 380-yard carry. No, Jimmy, I've seen you hit balls on the range, literally right beside you. You're not hitting at 380 yards in the air. One guy who I haven't seen on the range and I believe could hit 380 yards in the air if he had to, Bryson DeChambeau. This guy finishes the year with a 322.1 driving average. My understanding is that's kind of a new record out here, Scott. Can you confirm? Can you deny?
It barely eclipsed a mark set by Hank Keeney, who was 321.4 back in 2003. Hard to believe. Wow. So obviously the distances have been creeping up a little bit. You know, most people would probably assume if they saw that DeChambeau average, if they've been watching any of the broadcast of the PGA Tour, they would expect to see that average at 350 yards or 360 yards. But really, it's only been creeping up just by a little bit. Obviously, it's much bigger for him over what he was doing last year. So that makes it more impressive when he's comparing, you know, Bryson in 2020 versus Bryson in 2019. But overall, it's barely ahead of a mark that was set 17 years ago when the equipment was totally different.
Yeah, that's insane, though, that Hank Keeney was able to do that. But just one thing to know with that, Hank's career wasn't anything to write home about. This guy made $2 million total, 2.7 across, you know, 13 years on and off on the PGA Tour. Never picked up a win, a couple seconds. Back then, you know, they're talking about, you know, were they talking about the golf ball rolling back then? You know, like, oh, Hank's hitting it too far. Let's yeah. roll it back. Like, yeah, it's confusing to me. So I don't know. I still think we're a little too worried about Bryson. He picked up that win. He came out hot. But since then, where's Bryson been? You think with a rough out at East Lake, everyone's like, he's going to dominate out here this week. I don't even know his shot because the whole net scoreboard was too confusing for me in the first place. But still, like, I think maybe we can settle down a little bit on the Bryson hitting it so far. Because I bet if you said DJ hit it 320 on average, nobody would have been freaking out. Now Bryson does and everyone's freaking out.
Yeah, I think we touched upon that. We said it was hot for a moment. Everybody's talking about it. They think it's going to blow the tour apart. He's going to win every single week. That's not the case. I mean, golf is golf. There's a lot more to it than just hitting the ball a long way. You know, mentioning Keeney there, Keeney had some issues over the years, health issues, having alcoholism a little bit. So he had those issues as well. And then he was a freak off the tee. I mean, back in a time in 2003, when guys were probably spinning the ball 2,800, 2,900, this guy would have a hard time spinning the ball 1,500 or 1,600. So he was just hitting big, long knuckleballs, and he launched the ball like nobody else. And I know players, guys that worked on the tour back then would work with him doing fittings, and they would have a hard time fitting him into product. He just had a freak of a swing, obviously did something with the equipment back then. If he was playing now, I'd be really shocked and wonder what he would do. But again, as you mentioned, his record obviously didn't show much from it. DeChambeau has done okay from it, and obviously, you know, a difference from what he did last year, but he's not dominating, and, you know, we'll see what the fall brings.
Yeah, we got to track this guy down, Scotty. Let's get him out for an interview. I want to know about this guy's career because I don't think we've talked about this. This guy dated Venus Williams.
Yeah.
This guy's got a story to tell. We are tracking this guy down. My goal this year, Hank, we want you on this program. You know what everyone wants every single week? They want to hear from us, the mailbag. Scotty sent out the tweet earlier this week, so let's grab a quick break. Let's hit that mailbag and wrap it up with the tip of the week.
All right, welcome back. It's the mailbag, obviously one of our most popular segments. One, we love to answer your questions. We love having you send them in. This week, we've got a few for you to answer. And you know what? Some of them are based on some of the previous podcasts, including our recent one with Ian Fraser.
I like it. Let's hear it.
Yeah, so someone says they heard the Ian Fraser episode. How do I find a quality club fitter? Because obviously Ian talked a fair bit about that.
Yeah, I guess it depends on where you are more than anything. If you're around, you know, one of the big manufacturers, whether you're in the Toronto area, generally speaking, they all do them. But generally speaking, you know, look around golf clubs. Pretty much all manufacturers are going to come to each one to fit you. They're all trained to be fit.
to fit you for their stuff. If you're looking for something like what TXG does, where it's completely unbiased, though, you know, those don't come around too often. Outside of you know, golf courses and finding the right store per se, what other ideas do you have for them, Scott?
I think the biggest one is you want to go from the experiences of what other golfers that you trust. You know, you can reach out to some of your friends that have gone to some different fitters. They can find out about what the situation is when they go to those fitters. And I think that's an important aspect. You know, a lot of people can advertise they do this or they do that, but you really want to know about what happens when the people go. So I think seek out your friends that have gone to see, you know, a fitter, find out what they did, what their experience was like, you know, from the way that they, you know, did the actual fitting, how agnostic they were towards the equipment, you know, sales, how they backed it up as well. Ian mentioned last week that obviously they back up and guarantee what they're doing. So people can come back to them after their fitting is over and they buy equipment and they can do follow-ups as well. So I think your best thing here is word of mouth more than anything, but make sure you investigate it and find out how the experience was. Because if you have high expectations, you better make sure they're going to be met. All right, next one here, and this one is for you. Obviously, we had some guests on to talk about PGA Tour 2K21, and they're asking you, what was your favorite course so far on 2K21?
Oh, man, I've been playing this game so much. Whoever asks, reach out. Let's play sometime. The best part about this game is there are people out there that are investing. I haven't even looked at the course creator, but they must be investing, like, I'm not even joking. It must be like 60 hours to create these courses, minimum. And I found some very high-end courses. You know, I'm not going to name certain ones by name because they don't like that. But like, you can find Pebble Beach out there. You can find a lot of the Bandon courses out there. I really hope somebody is building, you know, Cabot and things along those lines, or Canadian golf courses. I don't know if there's any out there. If there has been, let me know. I'm deep though into my like PGA Tour career in there. And I'm just like Patrick Cantlay, man. I got 4 wins on a season somehow in this thing. Maybe this game's not realist. Patrick Cantlay has 9 wins in a season. How am I going to win the FedEx Cup against 9 wins? Thank God it's tiered when we get to East Lake. But no, I can't even think. I'm just kind of going through them all. But you know, the Bandon courses were great. They're under, I believe they're called Whiskey. If you just look Whiskey up, you'll
Whiskey
find
Run.
Them. Whiskey Run, Whiskey Dune.
Yeah, I saw a mention of that on Twitter.
Yeah, so go look for those. Those ones are fun for me. I like, when I'm playing, I like a lot of drivable par fours and gettable par fives and stuff like that. But this game's great. I can't wait for, you know, what the changes they're going to make in the future. But I'm having a blast. And if you want to play, reach out to me. Scott hasn't figured out how to turn on his Atari to hook up PGA Tour 2K21 yet to it. So you have to play me if you want to play.
All right. Sounds good. Hopefully I get some time this winter and maybe find a console that I can play on.
A converter to go from Atari to a new gen system.
Yeah. My Pong controllers don't really work too well with them. All right. We'll leave it at that. Number 3 here. What is the ugliest looking golf club you have ever seen? Wow. That's a big one.
From an ugly standpoint, those old square Nike drivers were hideous and they sounded worse. The alien wedge. Remember the alien wedge?
Oh, yeah.
It was ugly.
It's so long.
The Futura putter, though, is one. I'm going to go with the ugliest thing I've owned. It's got a camera Futura putter with the like half semicircle on the back and the two lines on the middle, and there's circles everywhere, and it probably costs so much money new because it's got Scotty Cameron's name, which shout out to their new putter, the Justin Thomas Special. Retailing at $1,200 USD for a signature and a bent shaft. That's my opinion and my opinion only. But yeah, no, it's for me, it's that Futura putter. That was the ugliest one I owned.
Yeah, for putters, definitely there's a lot of ones that are out there. I mean, people are pretty desperate about their putting. They'll take on anything that they can. And I had an STX putter. If you remember those, they're kind of a T-shaped putter. Mm-hmm. Jesper Parnevik played a version of that. I think Paul Huizinga did for a while. He called it the thing. That was a pretty ugly one. If we look at things like irons, Cleveland VAS irons, if you look up those online, you know, basically look like an oval shaped shovel, even though Corey Pavin used them to win a US Open. And then, you know, probably in the woods category, something like like Mac Bros. If you look at that, they had this little, I don't know, hurricane shape of a dent on the back underneath.
Dent really, is a good good description for a golf club. Sales feature. Comes pre-dented.
Yeah, pretty much. So as someone said, it looks like the cat's ass, if you want to think about that when you look at the bottom of it. But anyways, there's been some ugly ones over the years. Certainly, those are probably some of the ones. And you know what? I should probably do another column on that sometime. I know I did one a few years ago, probably talked about 5 or 10 of some of the worst looking products of all time. But, you know, there's been more than a few of those. So I'll leave it at that. All right. Simple one here for our next one. Plastic or wood tees?
Plastic all day, baby. Why would I use something that, A, I have two options of not having it in my pocket anymore. I can break it and I can just lose it. Why not just make that one option and I can just lose it, right? I think that's way better. I used to break tees all the time and I hate it. So I go with the packages that come with the big ones and then some of the small ones, all plastic all the time. Though that being said, if I go to a golf course and they have, you know, free tees there, I'll
free
take
tees.
Them. Yeah.
Just put the free word in there.
Yeah. Free tees, baby. I got the sweetest tees. I got an insider that played at the Arnold Palmer Invitational this year. They had amazing tees. They finally have made them up to Canada. They got the logo on them, say the Arnold Palmer Invitational on the side. Those are, I can't wait to get my hands on them. They're in Canada. I got to go find them at a friend's place, but those might be my new favorite tees. I will make sure to post those on social media when I see them.
Sweet. You know what? I used to be in the wood camp for a long time, you know, like a lot of traditionalists. I mean, plastic came along and you just didn't know kind of what they're about. You'd used wood tees your whole life, but I'm in the plastic camp now too. I mean, I know they bend a little bit, but you can bend them back and the same thing. I mean, there's nothing worse than all of a sudden getting up and have to have a pocket full of tees, hit one, break it, you know, save that for an iron shot someplace or whatever. And then, you know, dig back in your pocket to go hit a drive and you pull out some tee that's only an inch high, forget it. You know, throw one plastic tee in there. Like you said, if you lose it, you lose it, but you know, it's not going to break on you. It might bend, it's going to last a lot longer. So I'm in the plastic camp now.
How long did it take you to convert over from the dirt pile that you used to tee your ball up on to wooden tees? Were you part of the truthers of the dirt pile back in the day too, or what?
Well, I went with the ready tees about 100 years ago, which were the first short little tees. I still have a package of those around. I should challenge you to use those sometimes. And yeah, you're right. It was inconvenient to take the sand and have it wet and then clump it into a little, a little tee shape that you could put a ball on. But I would tell you eventually when the first plastic tees came out, they were crap. They would snap just like a wood tee. So there wasn't any advantage to them. But gradually they've made them a lot better, a lot more flexible. So they will last. And as a result, now I'm in that camp 100 years later. How's that?
We should play. There should be golf courses that, you know, ban tees and you have to just use the dirt. I think that would be fun.
Thanks, Nick Faldo.
Okay, sorry.
Actually, if you go to Oakhurst Links in West Virginia, they actually have a golf course there where you can still play the old rules from the 1880s when it was built, and they tee it up there. They've got buckets of sand there, and they've got a bucket of water, and you basically take a clump of it, wet it, shape it into a tee, and then you hit your replica old balls there as well and play hickory. So good luck with that.
Can't wait.
All right, on to the next one here. Should more golf courses allow fivesomes or more?
Yeah, of course. Let's make golf fun again. Why is this? I hate to break it to you. You're going to get two answers that say the exact same thing. As long as you're keeping up with the group in front of you, who cares how many are in your group? It's silly. I hate it. Why wouldn't golf courses do it? The amount of times I've called my golf course, be like, hey, any chance we can get 6 guys out? We're all good players. You're not going to worry about it. Nope. You just lost $200, right? Like, yeah. why wouldn't you take it? Let's have fun. I have zero problem with it as long as everyone's playing it right. You're going to have to bend the rules a little bit. And you're probably going to have to hit shots at the same time and it's not going to be all quiet, as usual, but you know, why not? Like, I'm so over the foursomes only crap.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I think you're right. I mean, if you look at the players, as long, and it doesn't matter whether they're good or they're bad players, it depends how they play from an etiquette standpoint, and as long as they move along and keep the pace, what's the you know, what's the negative out of it? Really, right now, we've got golf courses that don't have any tee times that are open. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in places like Texas, they play fivesomes all the time. They just get used to it, and that's what they do. The problem is that a lot of golf courses here have got that tradition of, it's a foursome. That's all you play. That's your maximum on your tee sheet. Well, when you ask them why they play foursomes, they have no idea. They just say, oh, it's because we do. Well, that doesn't necessarily make sense. So I played in groups as up to a 10, 11 with a dog. How's that? And moved along quite quickly, kept up to a threesome. It's more than possible to do. Obviously, you got to have the right players to do it. You got to have the right training to do it. But as I said, you know what? They do it in Texas. They do it in lots of other places where they play in fivesomes. Certainly more than capable of it happening. I think places need to explore that and see that maybe in certain options they need to do that. Maybe it's an afternoon or an evening, or they open that up, they experiment, they see how long it takes, and then they'll discover from there whether it's feasible or not for them.
You heard it here first, folks. If they do it in Texas, how bad could it be? Scott McCloud.
That's a bad quote. All right, last one here. This one was kind of funny because it comes from a buddy, and it really comes from, we were actually playing this week, and I'll get to it, but we were discussing this. Is the playthrough par the hardest one in the world to make?
For me, no. I find the playthrough, there's like this sense of confidence and swagger that comes over me, regardless if I had a double bogey on the previous hole. I'm like, watch this.
You like an audience.
Yeah. Like, this ain't no hobby, boys. As I'm probably like making, like, I'm probably like 2 under bogey golf as I'm making the turn through them. But yeah, I got no problem with it. That being said, we played through 2 groups last week, and I bogeyed both the holes, you and I. But for me, I don't have any problem with it. I have friends that can't do it, though. They get there. They'll try to hit shots. I'll just go up. I'll just meet at the green. Like, they can't handle it. I have no problem. I think it's, who cares?
Yeah, you know, the funny part was, this came from playing with a friend. We actually played through 2 groups, both made pars on both holes, and then kind of laughed about it because we said, man, this is like lightning in a bottle. But, you know, other people have said or commented to me when I've asked them about this. They said, well, the secret is you basically go up, and whatever putt, short putt that you have, you just pick up and pretend that you made it, and then you're good, as opposed to sitting there playing hockey and around the stick. But a lot of people, unfortunately, you know, they feel pressured, they rush. Other people have said to me when I put this out on Twitter, you know, hurry, but don't rush. I mean, that's really what it amounts to. So, you know, you can work through a lot of players, but, you know, you shouldn't really feel pressure. Chances are they're probably terrible too. So it doesn't really matter, right?
I agree. You both paid the same amount, so go play. Yeah,
there you go.
There you go.
And you're probably both not pros, so that's the way it goes, right?
Probably not. If you're playing through... Actually, I heard a funny story. I forget where I heard this, but something about this. It was actually in, I've been reading Caddy. I think it's Caddy for Life
It's
about Tom Watson's caddy, Bruce Edwards. And this story about this one guy. It was so hot, he left. He left on the back nine. He's like, I withdraw. And so the next guy went up to... his plan was to play through the rest of the nine on the Friday with the group ahead of him, because the other two guys in his group left. So threesome turning into a foursome. So he's trying to get up there, and a marshal's like, hey, where are your other two guys in the group? And he's like, oh, way right. In the woods, they're searching for their ball. So he's like, okay. So he went to look for him. Well, at this point, this guy whacks his ball, gets up on the green, takes his 2 putts, meets up with the next group, asks if he can play with them, and then the marshal next see them, and suddenly he's a foursome on the PGA Tour. And this wasn't like that long ago. We're talking like the 80s, which is still different than now, but I just think that's funny thinking about how that would look on the PGA Tour today.
It'd be a better story if it was a foursome, right?
That would be a better story if it was a foursome, yeah. Foursome on the PGA Tour, I'm all for it.
All right. Thanks, everyone. That's the mailbag for this week. Keep sending in your questions. We'll put out the notice every week. Send them in via our social media. We look forward to answering all your golf questions.
All right, Scott. Well, one question we get every week: how can I get better? So let's hit the tip of the week and wrap it up.
Yeah, well, for the tip of the week this week, I want to talk about managing yourself for better scoring. A lot of people that come to see me really think their golf game and their golf scores are all about technique and all about how they swing. But what they'll find a lot of times is how they manage themselves. And I know I'm going out and doing playing lessons with some of my students. I was out the other week with a student and, you know, we go down and play this par four. She hits a shot to the right. She's about 190 yards from the green, got some trees sort of in the way. And I ask her basically, you know, what shot you hit from 190 yards? For her, it was a 3-wood. Well, the only problem was she had a crappy lie. Ball's going to fly out there pretty low. Chances are it's going to hit the tree. Now, she's about a 25 handicap. Tendency for a lot of her scorecards, she has some high numbers. And a lot of her high numbers are from making bad decisions. She's got a decent swing. So, you know, what I did with her there is I just recommended she play left around the tree, pitch up onto the green, and then from there she could two putt and guarantee pretty much herself a bogey and possibly make a par as opposed to bringing in the tree into play. So what you have to do is to get rid of those big numbers. Taking out the mistakes is not necessarily about your golf swing. Sometimes it's about managing your game. So don't be afraid to engage your golf pro and say to your coach, your pro, hey, can we go out and do a playing lesson? I know my swing looks okay, but I'm not so great on the golf course. I'm probably making some bad decisions. Explore that. You'd be surprised how quickly you can knock some strokes off your game.
Man, bad decisions. That's been my my year. Just can't score. Striking the ball well, but just can't score. But what can you do? I'm going to get over it. I feel it this week. Yeah, I did break 80 for the first time in a while. It sounds bad. I broke 80 for the first time in a while this past weekend. Thank you. Hold your applause, everyone. Questions later. But I feel it. It's just around the corner. I need to get back. My best round of the year was my first round of the year. And I got to get back there. I'm going to get back there this week. I'm coming back on this program. I'm going to tell you about it. I know I've made a bunch of false promises recently. I keep thinking about the one about Dustin Johnson. I said I'm going to go back in his career and look at all the easy courses that he's maybe taken advantage of better than anyone. I don't even know where to start with something like this. So I'll get to that eventually. It's just, you know, who knows when. That'll be an off-season thing for us when it's a little bit quieter. We're not playing golf. But there's no off-season this year on the PGA Tour. We're right back at it. We have the Safeway Open. We got the U.S. Open the week after. It's exciting. It's about to get real exciting. We got multiple majors just back to back. We got Augusta in November. I can't wait. But we got to get through the Safeway Open this week first. So enjoy the Safeway Open, everyone. We'll be back next week. We'll chat with you then.